from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up, NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep joins us to talk about covering President Trump's impeachment, and we'll hear about his new book, Imperfect Union. It tells the story of political activists Jesse and John Fremont, a couple who explored and mapped the American West in the 1800s. Then at 10:50, the San Francisco 49ers are one game away from the Super Bowl. They compete with the Green Bay Packers in their first NFC Championship game in 7 years. We'll talk with the Chronicle's Ann Killian about this year's team and their chances going into Sunday's game. That's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Fremont, California, is only the largest U.S. city of many named after 19th century political figure John Fremont. An explorer known as the Pathfinder, Fremont is credited with coining the name Golden Gate for the port of the San Francisco Bay. And through his wife, Jesse's work publicizing his expeditions, Fremont gained political traction, becoming the first Republican nominee for president in 1856. John and Jesse Fremont significantly had impact in America in the midst of Western expansion, and that is written up by NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep in his new book, Imperfect Union. He joins us now to talk about his new book, and we're also going to get his take on impeachment and covering the Trump administration and really something of, well, his perspective of what's in the news. Welcome, Steve Inskeep.
Good morning, Michael. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you, and missed meeting you because of a rather significant historic moment here in studio.
Yes.
We've got you by phone, and I'm glad to talk with you. Really talk to you about this book, which I think is a very important book and a book that I really enjoyed. Let's talk about the news, though. I can't get away from the fact. I mean, an explosive story right now. And I'm talking about that Ukraine knew about essentially hitting Biden with this story by the Trump administration, what the impeachment is all about. Parnas, who is federally under indictment and maybe trying to reduce a sentence, implicates pretty much everybody else in the Trump administration. Let's just get your response.
It's been an incredible 24 hours or so of news. And I really don't mind talking about this at the same time we discuss this book, because when I write history, I feel like I'm getting the backstory to now, which I cover day to day. When we look at the allegations against President Trump, for which he is about to be on trial in the Senate, the essential story is the same after these revelations in the last few days, but we have new allegations and new details. Of course, the essential story is that the president pressured Ukraine to open investigations against his political rival, Joe Biden. There is a phone call showing the president asking for an investigation of Joe Biden. The president himself has admitted it. His budget director, Mick Mulvaney, said on video that there was a quid pro quo sought, that there were things demanded for investigations of Democrats. And so there's really not too much doubt about the actual story. But now we have these new details. For example, Marie-Louise Yovanovitch, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine up until early in 2019, is now said to have been the target of some kind of surveillance. This is something that Ukrainian officials are taking seriously enough that they've now said they're opening an investigation. Lev Parnas, a businessman who was helping the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to gather political dirt in Ukraine, has now given two interviews, one to the New York Times and one to Rachel Maddow of MSNBC, in which he's given extraordinary details that he says demonstrate how he was acting at the behest of Giuliani and acting at the behest of the president of the United States himself. Now, Parnas is a guy who has been indicted, who is accused of crimes, who would be defending himself and looking after his own interests. So we should not assume that everything he says is true until it checks out. But of course, he has also provided documents. There's even one more detail that I think is really telling here, Michael, and it has to do with the withholding of military aid to Ukraine. As people who've been following this know, the White House, for a period of months, held back that military aid, which Ukraine desperately needed for its war against Russia, its neighbor Russia. The White House, however, has defended itself, and the president's allies have defended themselves by saying, listen, the aid eventually flowed. In September, as this plan began to fall apart, it appears, the White House released the aid. The Ukrainians ultimately got it, and they will even defend President Trump because he signed the bill that allowed the aid in the first place. But the Government Accountability Office, which is an independent watchdog part of the government, has now concluded that the White House broke the law in the way that they withheld the aid. This was something that we know from other sources inside the White House, that White House officials were aware that they were at least up against the line, that they were skirting the law, that they were risking breaking the law here, or possibly even breaking the law. They seem to be aware of that, although they've insisted they didn't break the law in the end. But now this independent watchdog has come out, and I've had dealings with the GAO over the years. These are professional government servants. They speak very carefully. They are independent, but they speak in very measured tones. They don't throw wild accusations out generally. And so now we have the point of view of the GAO that, in fact, as part of this process, the president, in effect, broke the law.
The GAO is, we should mention, not only the Government Accountability Office, but is an office that claims to be nonpartisan and to a great extent has pretty much followed through on that, which brings up another question that I'm curious to get your response to. I mean, we could spend obviously the whole hour talking about this latest testimony that's come out of Parnas and the documents that back it up. But it gets to the question of how you decide what news stories to lead with and how you curate those news stories. I mean, NPR has a great reputation, as do you, for being, shall we say, nonpartisan, nonjudgmental when it comes to stories.
Thank you.
But it's very hard not to see things in a certain light and to keep your own perspective. I know, for example, when you're covering Iran, I was thinking to myself, geez, Steve's been to Iran a couple of times. He must have some strong views about what's happening over there. And nevertheless, we're supposed to be pretty much apart from that. It's very difficult, sometimes very challenging.
It is challenging. Yeah, I've been to Iran 6 times over the past decade, and that does give me, I suppose, a certain perspective on what goes on there. But hopefully what that means is that I bring a lot of knowledge to the table in trying to analyze and judge what is going on. And with that said, I try to keep my opinions out of it. And in fact, I try to keep my opinions a little less than final. As a journalist, at least, I try never to have a final view of anything. I try to be aware that I may still learn more information. Every day brings another opportunity to learn more information, which might change my perspective on the story. And it's pretty easy for me to maintain that perspective because I've been doing this for a while and I've seen it happen again and again and again. I remember covering a plane crash many years ago, and plane crashes are it's very common for it to seem to be one problem when the plane first crashes, and then later you find out a bit of science or a bit of information and you discover the actual cause was something else. And there was a week in which every single day a new fact was revealed that threw everything into a different light and appeared to point to a different cause for the plane crash. I keep that in mind when covering stories like the developing Iran situation or like the impeachment situation. Look what has just happened in the last 24 to 36 hours. Look how much more information we have. Information that, as I said, I don't think changes the fundamental direction of this story, but adds an enormous amount of detail.
And detail is what you manage, how's this for a transition, to particularly provide for us in your book. And I want to get to what inspired this book, because to some extent, you're giving us a whole new view, shall we say, of the Fremonts. I mean, we certainly have not relegated them to the dustbin of history, but they haven't been, at least in our major laser view of what's been going on in terms of history. Yet there's some extraordinary parallels to our own time, particularly in terms of the nativism that went on then right before the Civil War and the view of immigrants, the xenophobia with immigrants. But this is also just a fascinating couple. And what you're able to do with this couple is say, look, Fremont himself had all these cities and places named after him. There's a place near Monterey named after him, all throughout the United States, named the Golden Gate and all that. But the reality is his wife was a major player in establishing not only his reputation, but in all that he became known for.
Yeah, they were partners. And of course, that's true of many, many, many marriages. And it is true of many famous American historical figures that there are wives in the background or even not quite fully in the background, someone like Abigail Adams or Dolly Madison. But Jesse Benton Fremont was distinct. This was a marriage of two people who were very ambitious, who were involved in the American settlement of the West and also in the conquest of California from Mexico. John Charles Fremont was a U.S. Army officer, a member of something called the U.S. Army Corps of Topographical Engineers, and his job was to go out and map the West. He was an explorer, but we have to note that as an explorer, he didn't really discover that much that wasn't already known. What his real accomplishment was publicizing the American West and enticing people to settle there. That's why he was drawing maps of the Oregon Trail. That's why he was traveling to California. And that's why also he was writing beautiful, literary, evocative reports of his adventures in the West, which were published as popular books and as newspaper excerpts. And his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, was involved in that whole process. He would come home to her and begin writing his reports, and she would be taking dictation. She would be his secretary or his editor, and sometimes more of a writing partner or co-author, and sometimes a ghostwriter. And when he was away from Washington, she was his political representative in Washington because she was the daughter of a powerful United States senator and had grown up around other senators and grown up around presidents and had a remarkable self-confidence to do things that women were not really supposed to be doing in that era. She would tell off presidents and give her opinion even when she knew they disagreed. She would carry on brilliant conversations with senators more than twice her age who would seek her out because they appreciated her point of view. She was doing this all the time. She was lashing out at her husband's enemies. She was promoting her husband's friends and lobbying for them to be promoted in the Army. And she was also gradually building up a public image of her own as a political force in her own right. And that was a thing that was truly distinctive and truly rare for the era, for her to be famous, to become famous, even as she was working so hard to make her husband famous.
Well, you mentioned she was the daughter of a senator. That was Thomas Hart Benton. And if the name sounds familiar, the painter by the same name was her great uncle. But she was mostly, actually even at one point, trying to live her life as a man and was attacked for maybe taking on roles that were not supposed to be taken on by women in that time. In fact, I think it's important for just to realize what an extraordinary life she lived in so many untraditional ways. I was struck by the fact, for example, that Lincoln even said, President Lincoln, after he became president, said something to her to the effect of, you know, you're really quite a politician, aren't you?
Quite a female politician was the exact quote, according to Jessie exactly. Fremont in a letter. Yeah, she was given a man's name at birth, or a variant on a man's name. Thomas Hart Benton wanted a son, didn't get a son, and so he named her after his father, Jesse, adding an I in there, J-E-S-S-I-E. And she says in a memoir that when she was a girl, quote, my father gave me early the place a son would have had. She would trail along after him when he went hunting, and she would carry the bag with the limp, warm bird he had just shot. And she would trail along after him to the United States Senate, and she would trail along after him even to what we now call the White House to meet a succession of presidents, starting when she was a little girl and met, she says, Andrew Jackson. She wanted to have a political life. There was a point as a teenager in which she actually cut off her hair and told her father, I want to check out of Washington society. I can't stand it. I want to be your assistant. I want to live life as your assistant. And that was the moment when Senator Benton said this acting like a boy thing and getting educated like a boy and doing boy things. That's gone too far. It's time for you to be a woman now. And she obeyed that stricture, I want to say, and I think this is something that is really powerfully modern about this story. She kept and fulfilled her traditional roles, her traditional assigned gender roles as a wife, as a mother. She had children. She stayed at home while her husband went away for months or even years working out in the West. And yet she managed, while doing that, to add all of these other things into it that were considered a little beyond, or in some cases a lot beyond, the purview of women.
We're talking with Steve Inskeep, who, of course, is co-host of Morning Edition on National Public Radio, about his new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. And they are, by Steve's lights, the first celebrity couple. And, of course, many of us here in California know about Fremont's history as a cartographer, as a leader of expeditions, but also as someone who, like Huck Finn, lit out for the territories here back in 1845 and got rich in the gold rush in 1849 and even became known as the conqueror of California. What about that Helped Cause the Civil War, Steve?
Yeah, we can talk about that. It had to do first with the capture of territory and second with the Fremont's political career. We're talking about the era before the war, when the United States was divided in a way that might feel a little resonant now. The division then was not between red states and blue states or urban areas and rural areas. It was between the North and the South, and the divide was over slavery. Northern states had had slavery at the beginning of the country, but had gradually abolished it. Southern states, at the beginning of the country, sometimes their leaders talked about getting rid of slavery, but instead they embraced it and it became much more entrenched. Then, thanks in part to the work of Fremont and many other people, the United States began adding territory in the West and settling territory in the West, and the question came up as to whether the new Western territories and states would be slave or free. This was a question of power dynamics as well as economic power, because whichever side prevailed would have more force and more power and more population on their side. This became very divisive. Fremont was a part of that, and then a part of what came afterward. In the 1850s, there was a political upheaval in the United States. The political parties were fracturing. There was this giant movement that you mentioned against immigrants. The divide over slavery was getting wider and wider. And then a number of political leaders created the Republican Party, brand new political party, which was opposed to the expansion of slavery into the territories,
but would not take the stand abolitionists were taking.
No, they weren't. I mean, this is an incredibly racist time. We've got to be really clear about that. And I'm sure some Republicans who were privately abolitionists would also say that they were trying to obey the Constitution. They didn't want to interfere with slavery where it was, but they asserted that there was authority under the Constitution to prevent it from spreading further, and that's what they wanted to do. There'd never been a political party that had taken this stance, because national parties, if they were going to be serious contenders always in the past, had to appeal for northern and southern votes. And so you had to accommodate what was called the slave power. But Republicans realized there had been a demographic change in the country. Another thing that feels really modern as we watch the demographic change of the country now. In that time, the demographic change was that the population of the North had grown much more rapidly than the population of the South. And population in a democracy means power. And Republicans realized they had a chance to win the presidency with Northern votes alone, which means they could be an anti-slavery party. And their very first nominee, the first person who tried to become president in this novel way, was John Charles Fremont, nominated in 1856.
Who was endorsed by Frederick Douglass.
Endorsed by Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln campaigned for him. And the reason that I say that they helped cause the Civil War is that the South found this power of the Republican Party so threatening, the idea that they would be cut out of power and that Republicans would elect a president without any Southern support, they found that so threatening, they said that if it ever happened, they would leave the Union. They would secede. That was the threat in 1856. Didn't happen then because Fremont lost, but he had charted a path for Lincoln 4 years later, who tried the same thing and won, and the South did secede then.
Yeah, but let's not forget that James Buchanan, by many historical lights, the worst president who ever served in that office, some common consent up to this day.
Yeah, the guy who beat Fremont. Kind of awkward to be the person who was defeated for the presidency by the worst president ever, but that is part of Fremont's legacy, too.
And Fremont's legacy was also getting not only Buchanan elected, perhaps, but also having Buchanan essentially stand behind the Dred Scott decision of the High Court. But let me do this. Let me invite listeners. I know Steve Inskeep obviously has some chops when it comes to history, and actually wrote a book on Andrew Jackson, like John Meacham, and actually has a fascinating article you might want to read in The Atlantic about Andrew Jackson talking about comparisons that are often made to President Trump that really stop at the idea of who's going to widen the electorate. But I want to widen the discussion here, and I want to hear from you, our listeners, not only about Fremont and any questions you might have, but questions you might have for Steve Inskeep. We started off talking about the news, and you may want to bring that into the discussion as well. What's ever on your mind, you can join us now, and we invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. That number again, for your calls, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. And Roberta writes, I'm so excited that there's a new book about Jesse Benton. I found a copy of Immortal Wife by Irving Stone at a library book sale and loved it. She was a great woman, at least one of her books. One she wrote after John Fremont died is available free on Project Gutenberg. I've skimmed through it and plan to read the whole thing soon. Let's give a little perspective here, though. Didn't Jesse say something about people of Spanish origin being like fleas, or words to that extent?
Yeah, she certainly did. We should not make either of these people or any of the people in the story into angels. They're human beings. I think we can give them credit for being on the right side of history. They took a stand against slavery in 1856 and paid a great personal price for that. Jesse was an anti-slavery person from the South who, when she supported her husband for the presidency, lost contact with most of her relations. They turned away from her. So we can be impressed with that and respect that, while also recognizing that they said and did some horrible things. And yeah, Jesse traveled out to California. She was in San Francisco in the early days of the gold rush, and she mentioned the innumerable fleas in San Francisco, a bunch of shacks in which an increasing number of people lived on the hills, fleas everywhere. And to be fair, many sources that I consulted about San Francisco talked about fleas in that time. But she wrote this line, there were many fleas, as there are wherever the Spanish language is spoken. Now, that's a bigoted remark.
It's a bigoted remark, indeed.
And she would make those kind of acidic remarks from time to time. We have to understand, I don't say excuse, but understand that racial attitudes, even of people who were considered, we would say were progressive in their time, were not anything that we would accept now.
Well, like I often say, Washington and Jefferson were slave owners. And here's another comment about Immortal Wife. Recently, Daryl writes, I reread Irving Stone's book, Immortal Wife, and was intrigued by how the Fremonts embodied that time of U.S. and California history. I looked for movies about John Fremont and found none. I think the story of John and Jesse would make a great big screen historic drama film. There's a script for you, maybe, if you want to write it.
I'm in favor. Bring it on. That'd be just great. I'd be happy to help with that project. And yeah, I mean, it's visually stunning because they traveled all across the American West and they were in San Francisco and other parts of California for the gold rush. There's a war. It is an amazing, amazing story of ambition in a dramatic, dramatic time.
And lest we forget, this was also the time of the telegraph coming in and transcontinental travel and so many things that just changed the whole picture of what America was and what America would be. Steve Inskeep with us, reporter, co-host of Morning Edition for National Public Radio. And when we come back, we'll take your calls. You can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is NPR Steve Inskeep. He has a book out about a 19th century power couple, the Fremonts, and the book is called Imperfect Union. Doesn't necessarily refer to their union as a marriage, but there could be a case made there, possibly. Noelle wants to know, Steve, about, she says, I've heard that John Fremont's actions led to the deaths of many Native people in California. Did you write about that in your part on Fremont's military life? And I should mention that there are, since I talked about your book on Jackson, which is called Jacksonland, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
There's a lot of that Trail of Tears with the Cherokee driven out of their land that ties back to Fremont. But talk about that, if you would.
Yeah. Thanks for the question. It was Noelle, is that right? Noelle, thanks for your question. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you brought it up. There's a connection with Jacksonland because that was the story of pushing Indians out of the eastern United States, which was a tragic phase of America's westward expansion. The Fremonts were part of the next phase. John C. Fremont, most of the time, went among Indians carrying the lamps of science and reason and saw himself as an agent of civilization. And he hired Indians. He worked with Indians. He was polite to Indians. But then when he wrote about Indians afterward, he would give these patronizing, awful descriptions of what he considered savages and mock the way that they spoke English and that sort of thing. And when it got worse was when he came to California in 1845, 1846. So this is the period in which he's involved in the beginning of the conquest of California from Mexico, what became part of the U.S. war with Mexico, although in distant California, people didn't know the war had started yet or not. John Charles Fremont, in a series of incidents, his men massacred large numbers of Indians. It would be hard to say exactly how many, but he, for some reason, became convinced that American settlers in Northern California were endangered by natives. He said later that he thought the Mexicans who were beginning to fight this war were stirring up the Indians against him. I don't see independent evidence of that other than Fremont's word for it. In any case, he decided to launch a preemptive attack against the Indians, who hadn't launched a war against anybody at that point, and his men went from village to village to village, killing everybody that they could. One of his men later gave an oral history in which he said 175 Indians were killed. This guy's numbers are unreliable. There are other numbers in the oral history that are obviously wrong. But there's a second oral history by Kit Carson, a famous Westerner who was also ruthless in killing Indians on many instances. And he said there was no doubt that it was a perfect butchery that many Indians were killed. And that's just one of the incidents that I write about. There is another in which Klamath Indians in Oregon attacked Fremont's party and killed a couple of his men, and they went on a kind of collective punishment, an act of reprisal, went and found a Klamath village and burned it down, killing apparently women as well as men.
Steve, we've got a lot of calls for you. We'll get to as many as we can, and let's begin with Charles. Charles, you're on the air.
Yeah, I think you're cutting John C. Fremont a lot of slack, particularly when you consider the massacre of the Native Americans, the Wintu Indians, on the Sacramento River near the present-day city of Redding, mm-hmm. where they massacred every man, woman, and child. And the statistic is 1,000.
Steve Inske.
Hi, Charles. Thanks for that. I appreciate the number. And for all I know, that number is true, but I try to work with the most reliable information that I can. And one of the least reliable things to have is the statistic of the number of people killed in a war. And I'm just being honest with you about that. I would agree with Kit Carson's statement that it was a perfect butchery, that a great many Indians were killed. I would not only agree with that, I would assert that there were other instances, as I said, in which Fremont's men attacked Indian villages, burned them down, and killed everybody that they could kill. I am reluctant to give an exact number. I'm reluctant to endorse your number or the other numbers that I have found in my research. But there is no question, and my book says it was a lot, and it was a butchery, as Kit Carson said.
And let me thank Charles for his call and go right to another caller here. And let's go to you, Rob. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for being on.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Steve. Question for you is, my understanding is that Jesse Fremont was a pretty active keeper of a salon of intellectuals in San Francisco while John was out pathfinding, so to speak. And one of the people that she really influenced was young Carlton Watkins, who went on to be one of the preeminent photographers of the American West, engendering places like Yosemite and the greater consciousness of America at large, and leading Lincoln to make it a national park. Can you talk a little bit about her salon and that influence that she had on the thinkers of San Francisco? Maybe a bit of past prologue for today.
Yeah.
And the
no, I, 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 I really appreciate that. She was someone who collected interesting people who drew them into her circle wherever she was, in Washington or in San Francisco or elsewhere. Carlton Watkins, I believe, is in contact with her a little bit after the focus of my particular story, which is about the earlier parts of their lives. But I believe that you are correct, and he was not the only one. Jesse Fremont continued to do this throughout her life, even in John and Jesse's later lives, when John had blown all their money in bad railroad investments, and they were desperate to make a living. And even after 1890, when John died and Jesse was still alive and living in very modest circumstances in Los Angeles, she continued to be sponsors for different kinds of artists and intellectuals. There's another one that I want to call to your attention, and I'm probably going to pronounce this incorrectly, so forgive me. Gustav Borglum was a painter who painted John Charles Fremont late in his life, when Borglum was a very young man. And Jesse supported him every way she could. She couldn't be a patron of the arts by giving him money, but she had this famous, famous name, so she would write him letters of introduction to famous people in the United States and even in Europe. And Borglum became a sculptor. He began sculpting busts of presidents. And decades after he had painted John Charles Fremont, he went on to his greatest creation, which was Mount Rushmore. Part of the story of the guy whose life's work, whose great work in life was Mount Rushmore, was his support as a young artist from Jesse Fremont. And we could go through quite a list of people like that.
And let me thank Rob for his call. Steve Inskeep with us. His book is Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. And they are indeed and remain a celebrity couple, although when you read about
Guts
Steve
and Borglum, by the way, I'll say Guts and Borglum to get a little closer. Go on, Michael.
No, please. But I was just interested in the fact that when you read the NPR statements about you and your work and so forth, it emphasizes the fact that, yeah, you talk to a lot of famous people, but you prefer in some ways talking to they mentioned the Pennsylvania truck driver and the Kentucky coal miner and the U.S.-Mexican border detainees, but also California firefighters. Let's talk about that for just a moment. I mean, the difference between interviewing people or writing about people that, for that matter, who have celebrity status as opposed to just everyday ordinary people, because we do both and we take great pride in doing both.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's how you get a full picture of the world, right? And you learn an awful lot that way. It's amazing if you just walk up to almost any random person on the streets of San Francisco and start up a conversation. If you ask a few questions and listen thoughtfully to the answers, a story is likely to fall out. A really interesting story in many cases, a story of their family or why they're even living in San Francisco or what they're doing for a living or what their dreams are or the time they spent in San Quentin. Who knows what it is? But there's going to be a story there. And for many years at NPR, I've done a thing that I learned from the great political columnist David Broder. He used to conduct a practice every election that he covered of just knocking on hundreds of doors of almost random people in interesting political precincts and asked to get into their living rooms and just talk with them about what their concerns were. And that's a thing that I've done for the radio for many elections for many, many years in different ways. Sometimes I knock on doors. Sometimes we find people in parks and cafes and other places. And you want to talk to them, you want to listen to them, and you discover so much about the country. You discover that you're talking with the mother of a young man who just enlisted and is going into the military, and she starts crying. You discover that you're talking to someone who has been profoundly affected by the change of real estate values, which is a huge story up and down the West Coast, isn't it? You discover that you're talking with someone who has had an extraordinary experience or has an interesting opinion. And just about everybody has a story. I find that even when I go overseas, I get a chance to talk with Iranian officials. I've talked with the foreign minister. I've talked with the past two Iranian presidents, various other top Iranians. But the most interesting thing to do when I go there is to just talk to people on the street who are living in this unfree society where they aren't really supposed to speak their minds, and yet they do. They will get their opinion out to you one way or another if you just know how to listen for it. And it is infinitely more effective, more direct as a way of understanding a country than just talking to the people at the top.
Well, I want to get back to Fremont, but first we have some people who are critical, and I'd like to hear your response to their criticism.
Absolutely.
Ron writes, I often hear Mr. Inskeep press interviewees once about inaccurate information, but then the person simply reports his or her talking points and false information. Mr. Inskeep does not point out the interviewee's statements are false. Please keep pressing so the truth is revealed. And then Pete tweets, Steve Inskeep is taking much criticism, for myself included, for frequently soft-pedaling the abhorrent behavior of President Trump. Let's address that first, if we could. I mean, you're dispensing news and doing news analysis as well as broadcasting news in the age of Trump. It's a different age. It's a different era and epoch.
Well, I think that the basic standards apply, though, in that you want to demand facts. You want to demand truth. You question everybody. You give everybody a chance to tell their story, but you actually listen to it and push back. With the greatest respect to the two listeners, they said that I often did things. I invite them to come and find the numerous cases in which they feel that I did those things, because everything that I do is in public. Everything is searchable. The transcripts are searchable. The tapes are searchable. Write at NPR.org. Go and find the many, many occasions in which you feel that was done, and send me a letter, and let's see if the transcript shows that. I would agree that it is a mistake just to ask a question. The listener is absolutely right about the principle here. It's a mistake to just ask a question and let the politician say anything and not analyze it a little bit. It is also potentially a mistake to ask a question. They don't really answer the question, so you ask it again, and maybe you let it go. I suppose that does happen in some interviews, but it is often necessary and better to ask it three or four or five times. And I would suggest respectfully that that's something that I can point to examples in which we've done. I think that if someone is being doubtful or disingenuous or simply false, my job is to respectfully and calmly take whatever approach it is to make sure that the audience has the proper context to judge what was going on. It wasn't so long ago, a number of days ago, we had on a White House spokesperson, Pam Bondi, the former Attorney General of Florida, who is now part of the president's impeachment defense team. And she began making a number of false statements, saying that Republicans had been excluded from asking any questions during the House impeachment proceedings, which is simply false. And I think if you go back to the transcript, don't take my word for it. Go back to the transcript. Go back to the tape of that. You will hear me say that what her claims were. You'll hear me say that her claims were false. You will hear her assert the claim again. You will hear me say, stop, stop. And then instruct the engineer to turn down her microphone because she was continuing to talk. And then I stated the facts correctly again. You will hear her come back and make more misstatements, which I will then label misstatements because they were. And I'm happy to let her talk. I'm happy to let her have her point of view. I'd be happy to have her back on the program, along with any number of other officials. But if you're going to say something false, I'm just going to stop the interview for a moment and make sure that the audience knows that, and then we can go on. And when the interview was over, we went, as we commonly do, to an NPR correspondent to give context and perspective. And Tim Mak, one of our excellent, excellent congressional correspondents, came out of that interview and said, I'm very surprised that this White House official, who's part of their defense team, was not in any way knowledgeable with the transcripts of the House impeachment proceedings, in which Republicans are shown to have asked question after question after question. They were in the room, in spite of her false statement that they were not. So I invite people to go to that interview and see if it matches the complaint, if it matches the description of letting people get away with just telling lies.
Well, another listener wants to thank you for your work and says, however, I got so tired during the last election of hearing every newscast start with Trump, I had to turn it off. Perhaps this can be corrected during the next election cycle. And Mike wants to know if Fremont is a French name and asks about John Fremont's family history, which, by the way, a little time here left, but that is a fascinating thing in itself, because there was a kind of a birther thing that was going on with Fremont. He was born out of wedlock, and he was also Catholic, and those were things that made him, especially in the day of the Telegraph, easy target.
Yeah, I'll respond to both of those. First, I respect and understand that some people can't stand the president, can't stand the president's voice. He is the president of the United States. We're going to let you know what he says. And the more you dislike him, the more you should want to know what he is up to. My job is not just to bring you voices you agree with. In fact, any good news organization should be bringing you at least some voices you disagree with and make you angry and make you want to turn off the radio. Again, we're not there to just let them tell falsehoods, but to understand their perspective is vitally important. And that is equally true on the other side. If you're listening and you support the president, you should want to hear from Nancy Pelosi. You should want to hear from Chuck Schumer and any number of other Democrats. You want to know what the people you disagree with are up to. They might persuade you, and even if they never persuade you, you want to know what they're doing because that makes you a more effective citizen and more effective in countering the things that they do that you don't like.
Steve, forgive me. You're speaking my gospel, and nevertheless, you have to often educate listeners to that point of view. They don't necessarily side with you because they feel that, well, we're doing a disservice somehow if we don't come down against those that they are against.
No, I understand completely, and I understand people who say that everything is different now and that I should be shouting at guests and so forth. And I understand the emotion of the time. And I agree entirely with people who say we should not let people come on the air and just say false things unchallenged all the time. We should be questioning. We should be challenging. We should be giving context, regardless of where anybody is in the political spectrum. So I agree with that, and I understand the emotion. I'm just explaining how it is that I feel I need to go about my job as a citizen, which is really all a journalist is a citizen. Now, you had another question there, I guess, about John Charles Fremont and his name. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a quick question we can go to, too, please.
Yeah, and, well, anything you want. I'm here for you to the top of the hour, sir. But Fremont is an interesting person because he was born the illegitimate son of a French immigrant, a man, and a Virginia aristocrat who had left her husband to be with this man, Charles Fremont, F-R-E-M-O-N. And John Charles Fremont changed the spelling of his name in his teenage years, it appears. He added a T on the end. He later added an accent mark over the E. He sometimes went by Charles Fremont. He sometimes went by C.J. Fremont. He eventually put his name back in order and was John C. Fremont as a famous person. He was a guy who was making his own identity, who had this past that was considered way more shameful in the 19th century than it is now because he had been born out of wedlock. And this was something that he hid and that his brilliant wife, Jessie, went out of her way to hide. And in fact, when it came time for him to run for president in 1856, she wanted evidence that, in fact, he had been born inside a marriage. She was unable to find it because he wasn't. So when a supporter was writing a campaign biography, she took over the first chapter and just wrote that, in fact, he had been born legitimately. She just lied to cover it up. Nevertheless, this all becomes politically significant because he was running in this time of fierce anti-immigrant sentiment. And here he is, the illegitimate son of an immigrant. So first, his political opponents revealed that he was of illegitimate birth and the son of an immigrant. And second, they began improving the story and said not only was he the son of an immigrant, he was himself an immigrant. He was born outside the United States, and therefore, they said, ineligible for the presidency. So it's exactly as you said, Michael. There were birthers in 1856.
Steve, I'm afraid we can't go to the top of the hour here because we've got to pay some attention to the fact that the San Francisco 49ers are in an NFL championship, and we're going to talk to Chronicle writer Ann Killian. But so good
there
to have
you
on, and onward and upward, and thank you for being with us this time, and congratulations again on the book. It's called Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. Thank you so much again.
It's an honor to be here, and good luck talking about the 49ers.
All right, and good luck to you as well.